Reports and Dispatch. I thought it was a good thing he wasn't going hunting with Ian. He reeked of camphor as much as I did. The animals would send him a mile away. Tucking me tenderly under the quilts, he had left me to sleep while he went to greet Duncan more formally and offer him the hospitality of the house. I could hear the deep murmur of their voices outside now. They were sitting on the bench beside the door, enjoying the last of the afternoon sunshine. Long, pale beams slanted through the window, lighting a warm glow of pewter and wood within. The sun touched the skull, too. This stood on my writing table across the room, composing a cosily domestic still life with a clay jug filled with flowers and my casebook. It was the sight of the casebook that roused me from torpor. The birth I had attended at the Müller's farm now seemed vague and insubstantial in my mind. I thought I'd better record the details while I still recalled them at all. Thus, prompted by the stirrings of professional duty, I stretched, groaned, and sat up. I still felt mildly dizzy, and my ears rang from the after-effects of brandy wine. I was also faintly sore almost everywhere, more in some spots than others, but generally speaking, I was in decent working order. Beginning to be hungry, though. I did hope Ian would come back with meat for the pot. I knew better than to gorge my shriveled stomach on cheese and salt fish, but a nice strengthening squirrel broth, flavoured with spring onions and dried mushrooms, would be just what the doctor ordered. Speaking of broth, I slid reluctantly out of bed and stumbled across the floor to the hearth, where I poured the cold barley soup back into the pot. Ian had made enough for a regiment, always supposing the regiment to be composed of Scots. Living in a country normally barren of much that was edible, they were capable of relishing glutinous masses of cereal, untouched by any redeeming hint of spice or flavour. From a feebler race myself, I didn't feel quite up to it. The open bag of barley stood beside the hearth, the burlap sack still visibly damp. I would have to spread the grain to dry, or it would rot. My bruised knee protesting a bit, I went and got a large flat tray basket made of plaited reeds, and knelt to spread the damp grain in a thin layer over it.
"Will he have a soft mouth then, Duncan?"
Jamie's voice came clearly through the window. The hide covering was rolled up to let in air, and I caught the faint tang of tobacco from Duncan's pipe.
"He's a big, strong brute, but he's got a kind eye." "Oh, he's a bonny wee fellow," Duncan said, the note of pride in his voice unmistakable. "And a nice soft mouth eye. Miss Jew had her stableman pick him from the market in Wilmington. Said he must find a horse could be managed well wi' one hand." "Mm-hmm. Aye, well, he's a lovely creature."
The wooden bench creaked as one of the men shifted his weight. I understood the equivocation behind Jamie's compliment, and wondered whether Duncan did as well. Part of it was simple condescension. Jamie had been raised on horseback, and, as a born horseman, would scorn the notion that hands were necessary at all. I had seen him manoeuvre a horse by the shifting pressure of knees and thighs alone, or set his mount at a gallop across a crowded field, the reins knotted on the horse's neck to leave Jamie's hands free for sword and pistol. But Duncan was neither a horseman nor a soldier. He had lived as a fisherman near Ardrossan until the rising had plucked him, like so many others, from his nets and his boat, and sent him to Culloden and disaster. Jamie wouldn't be so untactful as to point up an inexperience of which Duncan was more than aware already. He would, though, mean to point up something else. Had Duncan caught it?
"It's you she means to help, McDo, and well you ken it, too."
Duncan's tones were very dry. He'd taken Jamie's point all right.
"I havena said otherwise, Duncan."
Jamie's voice was even.
"Mm-hmm."
I smiled, despite the air of edginess between them. Duncan was every bit as good as Jamie at the Highland art of inarticulate eloquence. This particular noise captured both mild insult at Jamie's implication that it was improper for Duncan to be accepting the gift of a horse from Jocasta, and a willingness to accept the likewise implied apology for the insult.
"Have ye thought, then?"
The bench creaked as Duncan abruptly changed the subject.
"Will it be Sinclair or Geordie Chisholm?"
Without giving Jamie time to reply, he went on, but in a way that made it clear that he had said all this before. I wondered whether he was trying to convince Jamie or himself, or only assist them both in coming to a decision by repeating the facts of the matter.
"It's true Sinclair's a cooper, but Geordie's a good fellow, a thrifty worker, and he's the two wee sons besides. Sinclair isn't a married, so he wouldn't need so much in the way of setting up, but..." "He'd need lathes and tools and iron and seasoned wood," Jamie broke in. "He could sleep in his shop, aye, but he'll need the shop to sleep in, and it will cost very dear, I think, to buy all that's needed for a cooperage. Geordie would need a bit of food for his family, but we can provide that from the place here. Beyond that, he'll need no more to begin than a few wee tools. He'll have an axe, aye?"
"Aye, he'll have that from his indenture, but it's the planting season now, McDo, with the clearing."
"I ken that well enough,"
Jamie said, a bit testily.
"It's me that put 5 acres in corn a month ago, and cleared them first."
While Duncan had been taking his ease at River Run, chatting in taverns and breaking in his new horse. I heard it, and so did Duncan. There was a distinct silence that spoke as loud as words. A creak from the bench, and then Duncan spoke again mildly.
"Your Auntie Jo sent a wee gift for you."
"Oh, has she?"
The edge in his voice was even more perceptible. I hoped Duncan had sense enough to heed it.
"A bottle of whisky?"
There was a smile in Duncan's voice, answered by a reluctant laugh from Jamie.
"Oh, has she?"
he said again, in quite a different tone.
"That's very kind. She means to be."
There was a substantial creak and shuffle as Duncan got to his feet.
"Come, wee man, fetch it then, McDo. A wee drink wouldn't do your temper any harm." "No, I wouldn't."
Jamie sounded rueful.
"I've not slept the night, and I'm cranky as a rutting boar. You'll forgive my manners, Duncan."
"Och, dinna speak of it."
There was a soft sound, as of a hand clapping a shoulder, and I heard them walk off across the yard together. I moved to the window and watched them, Jamie's hair gleaming dark bronze in the setting sun, as he tilted his head to listen to something Duncan was telling him, the shorter man gesturing in explanation. The movements of Duncan's single arm threw off the rhythm of his stride, so he walked with jerky movements, like a large puppet. What would have become of him, I wondered, had Jamie not found him, and found a place for him? There was no place in Scotland for a one-armed fisherman. There would have been nothing for him but beggary, surely. Starvation, perhaps, or theft to live, and death at the end of a rope, like Gavin Hayes. But this was the new world, and if life was chancy here, well, it meant a chance at life, at least. No wonder that Jamie should worry over who should have the best chance, Sinclair the cooper, or Chisholm the farmer. A cooper would be valuable to have at hand. It would save the men on the ridge the long trip into Cross Creek or Aversborough to fetch the barrels needed for pitch and turpentine, for salted meat and cider. But it would be expensive to set up a cooper's shop, even with the bare rudiments the trade required. And then there was the unknown Chisholm's wife and small children to be considered. How were they living now, and what might become of them without help? Duncan had so far located 30 of the men of Ardsmuir. Gavin Hayes was the first, and we had done for him all that could be done, seen him safe into heaven's keeping. 2 more were known dead, one of fever, one of drowning. 3 had completed their terms of indenture, and, armed only with the axe and suit of clothes that were a bondsman's final pay, had managed to find a foothold for themselves, claiming backcountry land and carving out small homesteads there. Of the remainder, we had brought 20 so far to settle on good land near the river under Jamie's sponsorship. Another was feeble-minded, but worked for one of the others as a hired man and so earned his keep. It had taken all of our resources to do it, using all our small quantity of cash, notes against the value of as yet non-existent crops, and one hair-raising trip into Cross Creek. Jamie had called upon all his acquaintance there, borrowing small amounts from each, and had then taken this money to the riverside taverns where, in 3 sleepless nights of play, he had managed to quadruple his stake, narrowly avoiding being knifed in the process, as I learned much later. I was speechless, looking at the long, jagged rent in the bosom of his coat. "What?" I croaked at last. He shrugged briefly, looking suddenly very tired.
"It doesn't matter," he said. "It's over."
He had then shaved, washed, and gone round to all the plantation owners again, returning each man's money with thanks and a small payment of interest, leaving us with enough to manage seed corn for planting, an extra mule for ploughing, a goat, and some pigs. I didn't ask him anything else, only mended the coat and saw him safely into bed when he came back from repaying the money lent. I sat by him for a long time, though, watching the lines of exhaustion in his face ease a little as he slept. Only a little. I had lifted his hand, limp and heavy with sleep, and traced the deep lines of his smooth, calloused palm over and over. The lines of head and heart and life ran long and deep. How many lives lay in those creases now? My own. His settlers. Fergus and Massali, who had just arrived from Jamaica, in the custody of Germaine, a chubby blonde charmer who had his besotted father in the palm of his fat little hand. I glanced involuntarily through the window at the thought. Ian and Jamie had helped to build them a small cabin only a mile from our own. Sometimes Massali would walk over in the evenings to visit, bringing the baby. I could do with seeing him, I thought wistfully. Lonely as I sometimes was for Bree, little Germaine was a substitute for the grandchild I would never hold. I sighed and shrugged away the thought. Jamie and Duncan had come back with the whiskey. I could hear them talking by the paddock, their voices relaxed, all tension between them eased, for the moment. I finished spreading out a thin layer of the wet barley and set it in the corner of the hearth to dry, then went to the writing table, uncapped the inkwell, and opened my casebook. It didn't take long to record the details of the newest Müller's arrival into the world. It had been a long labour, but otherwise quite normal. The birth itself had presented no complications. The only unusual feature had been the child's call. I stopped writing and shook my head. Still distracted by the thoughts of Jamie, I had let my attention wander. Petronella's child hadn't been born with a call. I had a clear memory of the top of the skull crowning, the pudendum, a shiny red ring stretched tight around a small patch of black hair. I had touched it, felt the tiny pulse throbbing there just under the skin. I remembered vividly the sensation of the wet down against my fingers, like the damp skin of a new-hatched chick. It was the dream, I thought. I had dreamed in my burrow, mingling the events of the 2 births together, this one and Brianna's. It was Brianna who had been born with a call. A silly who, the Scots called it. A lucky hood. A fortunate portent, a call offered, they said. Protection from drowning in later life. And some children born with a call were blessed with second sight. Though, having met one or two of those who saw with the third eye, I took leave to doubt that such a blessing was unmixed. Whether lucky or not, Brianna had never showed any signs of that strange Celtic knowing, and I thought it just as well. I knew enough of my own peculiar form of second sight, the certain knowledge of things to come, not to wish its complications on anyone else. I looked at the page before me. Only half noticing, I had sketched the rough outline of a girl's head. A curving, thick line of swirling hair, the bare suggestion of a long, straight nose. Beyond that, she was faceless. I was no artist. I had learned to make clean, clinical drawings, accurate pictures of limbs and bodies. But I lacked Brianna's gift of bringing lines to life. The sketch as it stood was no more than an aide-mémoire. I could look at it and paint her face in memory. To try to do more, to conjure flesh out of the paper, would be to ruin that, and risk losing the image I held of her in my heart. And would I conjure her in the flesh if I could do it? No, that I would not. I would 1,000 times rather think of her in the safety and comfort of her own time than wish her here amid the harshness and dangers of this one. But it didn't mean that I didn't miss her. For the first time, I felt some small sympathy for Jocasta Cameron and her desire for an heir, someone to remain behind, to take her place, testimony that her life hadn't been lived in vain. Twilight was rising beyond the window, from field and wood and river. People spoke of night falling, but it didn't really. Darkness rose, filling first the hollows, then shadowing the slopes, creeping imperceptibly up tree trunks and fence posts as night swallowed the ground and rose up to join the greater dark of the star-spread sky above. I sat staring out the window, watching the light change on the horses in the paddock, not so much fading as altering, so that everything, arched necks, round rumps, even single blades of grass, stood stark and clean, reality freed for one brief moment from the day's illusions of sun and shadow. Unseeing, I traced the line of the drawing with my finger, over and over, as the dark rose up around me, and the realities of my heart stood clear in the dusky light. No, I wouldn't wish Brianna here. But that didn't mean I didn't miss her. I finished my notes eventually, and sat quietly for a moment. I should go and begin making supper, I knew, but the weariness of my ordeal still dragged at me, making me unwilling to move. All my muscles ached, and the bruise on my knee throbbed. All I really wanted to do was to crawl back into bed. Instead, I picked up the skull, which I had set down next to my casebook on the table. I ran my finger gently over the rounded cranium. It was a thoroughly macabre desk ornament, I would admit that, but I felt rather attached to it nonetheless. I had always found bones beautiful, of man or beast, stark and graceful remnants of life reduced to its foundations. I thought suddenly of something I hadn't remembered in many years, a small dark closet of a room in Paris, hidden behind an apothecary's shop. The walls covered with a honeycomb of shelves, each cell holding a polished skull. Animals of many kinds, from shrews to wolves, mice to bears. And with my hand on the head of my unknown friend, I heard Master Raymond's voice, as clear in memory as though he stood beside me. "Sympathy," he had said as I touched the high curve of a polished elk's skull. "It is an unusual emotion to feel for a boon, Madonna." But he had known what I meant. I knew he did, for when I asked him why he kept these skulls, he had smiled and said, "They are company, of a sort." I knew what he meant, too, for surely the gentleman whose skull I kept had been company for me in a very dark and lonely place. Not for the first time, I wondered whether he had in fact had anything to do with the apparition I had seen on the mountain, the Indian with his face painted black. The ghost, if that is what he was, hadn't smiled or spoken aloud. I hadn't seen his teeth, which would be my only point of comparison with the skull I held, for I found that I was holding it, rubbing a thumb over the jagged edge of a cracked incisor. I lifted the skull to the light, examining it closely by the soft sunset light. The teeth on the one side had been shattered, cracked and splintered as though he had been struck violently in the mouth, perhaps by a rock or a club, the stock of a gun. On the other side, they were whole, in very good condition, actually. I was no expert, but thought the skull was that of a mature man, one in his late 30s or early 40s. A man of that age should show a good bit of wear to his teeth, given the Indian's diet of ground corn, which, owing to the manner of preparation, pounded between flat stones, contained quite a bit of ground stone as well. The incisors and canine on the good side were scarcely worn at all, though. I turned the skull over to judge the abrasions of the molars and stopped cold. Very cold, in spite of the fire at my back. As cold as I had been in the lost, fireless dark, alone on the mountain with a dead man's head. For the late sun now struck sparks from my hands, from the silver band of my wedding ring, and from the silver fillings in my late companion's mouth. I sat staring for a moment, then turned the skull over and set it gently down on the desk, careful as though it were made of glass. "My God," I said, all tiredness forgotten. "My God," I said to the empty eyes and the lopsided grin. "Who were you?"
"Who do you think he could have been?"
Jamie touched the skull gingerly. We had no more than moments. Duncan had gone to the privy, Ian to feed the pig. I couldn't bring myself to wait, though. I had had to tell someone at once. "I haven't the faintest idea. Except, of course, that he has to have been someone like me." A violent shiver ran over me. Jamie glanced at me and frowned.
"You haven't taken a chill, have you, Sasnach?"
"No." I smiled weakly up at him. "Goose walking on my grave, I expect." He plucked my shawl from the hook by the door and swung it around me. His hands stayed on my shoulders, warm and comforting.
"It means the one thing else, doesn't it?"
he asked quietly.
"It means there is another place, perhaps nearby."
"Another stone circle, or something like it." I had thought of that too, and the notion made me shudder once again. Jamie looked thoughtfully at the skull, then drew the handkerchief from his sleeve and draped it gently over the empty eyes.
"I'll bury him after supper," he said.
"Oh, supper." I pushed my hair behind my ear, trying to get my scattered thoughts to focus on food. "Yes, I'll see if I can find some eggs. That will be quick."
"Dinna trouble yourself, Sasnach."
Jamie peered into the pot on the hearth.
"We can eat this."
This time the shudder was purely one of fastidiousness.
"Ugh,"
I said. Jamie grinned at me.
"Nothing wrong with good barley crowdy, is there?"
"Assuming there is such a thing," I replied,
looking into the pot with distaste.
"This smells more like distiller's mash."
Made with wet grain, insufficiently cooked, and left standing, the cold, scummy soup was already giving off a yeasty whiff of fermentation.
"Speaking of which," I said, giving the open sack of damp barley a poke with my toe, "this needs to be spread to dry before it starts to mould, if it hasn't already."
Jamie was staring at the disgusting soup, brows furrowed in thought.
"Aye,"
he said absently. Then, coming to consciousness,
"Oh, aye, I'll do it."
He twisted shut the top of the bag and heaved it onto his shoulder. On the way out, he paused, looking at the shrouded skull.
"You said you didn't think him Christian," he said,
and glanced curiously at me.
"Why was that, Sasnach?"
I hesitated, but there was no time to tell him about my dream, if that's what it had been. I could hear Duncan and Ian in conversation, coming toward the house.
"No particular reason," I said with a shrug.
"Aye, well," he said, "we'll give him the benefit of the doubt."
Chapter 24. Letter Writing. The Great Art o' Love. Oxford, March 1971.
Roger supposed it must rain as much in Inverness as it did in Oxford, but somehow he had never minded the northern rain. The cold Scottish wind sweeping in off the Moray Firth was exhilarating, and the drenching rain both stimulation and refreshment to the spirit. But that had been Scotland when Brianna was with him. Now she was in America, he in England, and Oxford was cold and dull, all its streets and buildings grey as the ash of dead fires. Rain pattered on the shoulders of his scholar's gown as he dashed across the quad, shielding an armload of papers under the poplin folds. Once, in the shelter of the porter's lodge, he stopped to shake himself, dog-like, flinging droplets over the stone passage.
"Any letters?" he asked. "Think so, Mr. Wakefield. Just a sec."
Martin disappeared into his inner sanctum, leaving Roger to read the names of the college's war dead, carved on the stone tablet inside the entry.
George Van Landingham, Esquire. The Honourable Philip Mingus. Joseph William Roscoe.
Not for the first time, Roger found himself wondering about those dead heroes and what they'd been like. Since meeting Brianna and her mother, he'd found that the past too often wore a disturbingly human face.
"Here you are, Mr. Wakefield."
Martin leaned beaming across the counter, holding out a thin sheaf of letters.
"One from the States today," he added with a broad wink.
Roger felt an answering grin break out on his face, and a warm glow spread at once from his chest, through his limbs, dispelling the chill of the rainy day.
"Will we be seeing your young woman up soon, Mr. Wakefield?"
Martin craned his neck, peering frankly at the letter with its U.S. stamps. The porter had met Brianna when she'd come down with Roger just before Christmas, and had fallen under her spell.
"I hope so. Perhaps in the summer. Thanks."
He turned toward his staircase, tucking the letters carefully into the sleeve of his gown while he groped for his key. He felt a mingled sense of elation and dismay at the thought of the summer. She'd said she'd come in July, but July was still 4 months away. In some moods, he didn't think he'd last 4 days. Roger folded the letter again and tucked it into his inside pocket, next to his heart. She wrote every few days, from brief notes to long screeds, and each of her letters left him with a small warm glow that lasted usually until the next arrived. At the same time, her letters were faintly unsatisfactory these days. Still warmly affectionate, always signed Love, always saying she missed him and wanted him with her. No longer the sort of thing that burned the page, though. Perhaps it was natural, a normal progression as they knew each other longer. No one could go on writing passionate missives day after day, not with any honesty. No doubt it was only his imagination that Brianna seemed to hold back a bit in her letters. He could do without the excesses of one friend's girl, who had clipped bits of her pubic hair and included them in a letter, though he rather admired the sentiment behind the gesture. He took a bite of his sandwich and chewed absent-mindedly, thinking of the latest article Fiona had showed him. Now married, Fiona considered herself an expert on matters matrimonial and took a sisterly interest in the bumpy course of Roger's love affair. She was constantly clipping helpful hints from women's magazines and mailing them to him. The latest had been a piece from My Weekly, entitled How to Intrigue a Man. "Sauce for the gander," Fiona had written pointedly in the margin.
"Share his interests," one tip advised. "If you think football's a loss, but he's dead keen, sit down beside him and ask about Arsenal's chances that week. If football's boring, he isn't."
Roger smiled a little grimly. He'd been sharing Brianna's interests, all right, if tracking her bloody parents through their hair-raising history counted as a pastime. Damn little of that he could share with her, though.
"Be coy," said another of the magazine's tips. "Nothing piques a man's interest more than an air of reserve. Don't let him get too close, too soon."
It occurred to Roger to wonder whether Brianna had been reading similar advice in American magazines, but he dismissed the thought. She wasn't above reading fashion magazines. He had seen her do it on occasion. But Brianna Randall was as incapable of playing that sort of silly game as he was himself. No, she wouldn't put him off just to raise his interest in her. What would be the point? Surely she knew just how much he cared about her. Did she, though? With a qualm of uneasiness, Roger recalled another of My Weekly's tips to the Lovelorn. "Don't assume he can read your mind," the article said. "Give him a hint of how you feel." Roger took a random bite of the sandwich and chewed, oblivious to its contents. Well, he'd hinted all right. Come out and bared his bloody soul. And she'd promptly leapt into a plane and buggered off to Boston. "Don't be too aggressive," he murmured, quoting tip number 14, and snorted. The woman Dom next to him edged slightly away. Roger sighed and deposited the bitten sandwich distastefully on the plastic tray. He picked up the cup of what the dining hall was pleased to call coffee, but didn't drink it, merely sat with it between his hands, absorbing its meagre warmth. The trouble was that while he thought he had succeeded in deflecting Brianna's attention from the past, he had been unable to ignore it himself. Claire, that bloody Highlander of hers, obsessed him. They might as well have been his own family for the fascination they held. Always be honest, tip number 3. If he had been, if he'd helped her to find out everything, perhaps the ghost of Jamie Fraser would be laid now. And so would Roger. "Oh, bugger," he muttered to himself. The woman next to him crashed her coffee cup onto her tray and stood up suddenly. "Go bugger yourself," she said crisply, and walked off. Roger stared after her for a moment. "No fear," he said. "I think maybe I already have." Chapter 25. Enter a Serpent. October 1768. In principle, I had no objection to snakes. They ate rats, which was laudable of them. Some were ornamental, and most of them were wise enough to keep out of my way. Live and let live was my basic attitude. On the other hand, that was theory. In practice, I had any number of objections to the huge snake curled up on the seat of the privy. Beyond the fact that he was gravely discommoding me at present, he wasn't usefully eating rats, and he wasn't aesthetically pleasing either, being a sort of drab grey with darker splotches. My major objection to him, though, was the fact that he was a rattlesnake. I suppose that in a way it was fortunate that he was. It was only the heart-stopping buzz of his rattles that had prevented me sitting on him in the dawn's early light. The first sound froze me in place just inside the tiny privy. I extended one foot behind me, groping gingerly for the door-sill. The snake didn't like that. I froze again as the warning buzz increased in volume. I could see the vibrating tip of his tail, sticking up like a thick yellow finger, rudely pointing from the heap of coils. My mouth had gone dry as paper. I bit the inside of my cheek, trying to summon a little saliva. How long was he? I seem to recall Brianna's telling me, from her Girl Scout handbook, that rattlesnakes were capable of striking at a distance up to one-third their own body length. No more than 2 feet separated my nightgown-covered thighs from the nasty flat head with its lidless eyes. Was he 6 feet long? It was impossible to tell, but the squirm of coils looked unpleasantly massive, the rounded body thick with scaled muscle. He was a bloody big snake, and the fear of being ignominiously bitten in the crotch if I moved was enough to make me stand still. I couldn't stand still forever, though. Other considerations aside, the shock of seeing the snake hadn't decreased the urgency of my bodily functions in the slightest. I had some vague notion that snakes were deaf. Perhaps I could shout for help. But what if they weren't? There was that Sherlock Holmes story about the snake who responded to a whistle. Perhaps the snake would find whistling inoffensive, at least. Cautiously, I pursed my lips and blew.
Nothing came out but a thin stream of air.
"Claire," said a puzzled voice behind me, "what the hell are you doing?"
I jumped at the sound, and so did the snake. Or at least it moved suddenly, flexing its coils in what appeared to be imminent attack. I froze to the doorframe, and the snake quit moving, except for the chronic whir of its rattles, like the annoying buzz of an alarm clock that wouldn't shut off.
"There's a fucking snake in here," I said, through my teeth, trying not to move even my lips. "Well, why are you standing there? Move aside and I'll pitch out."
I could hear Jamie's footsteps coming close. The snake heard him too. Obviously, it wasn't deaf, and revved up its rattling.
"Ah," Jamie said, in a different tone of voice.
I heard a rustle as he stooped behind me.
"Stand still, Sassenach."
I hadn't time to respond to this piece of gratuitous advice before a heavy stone whizzed past my hip and struck the snake amidships. It sprang into something resembling a Gordian knot, squirmed, writhed, and fell into the privy, where it landed with a nasty sort of hollow thwack. I didn't wait to congratulate the victorious warrior, but instead turned and ran for the nearest patch of woods, the dew-wet hem of my nightgown slapping round my ankles. Returning a few minutes later, in a more settled frame of mind, I found Jamie and young Ian squeezed into the privy together, a tight fit considering their sizes, the latter squatting on the bench with a pine knot torch, as the former bent over the hole, peering into the depths beneath.
"Can they swim?"
Ian was asking, trying to see past Jamie's head without setting his uncle's hair on fire.
"I dinna ken," Jamie replied dubiously. "I think maybe so. What I want to know is, can they jump?"
Ian jerked back, then laughed a little nervously, not altogether sure that Jamie was joking.
"Here, I canna see a thing. Hand me the light."
Jamie reached up to take the splinter of pine from Ian and lowered it gingerly into the hole.
"If the stink doesn't put the flame out, belike we'll burn down the privy," he muttered, bending low. "Now then, where the devil?"
"There it is! I see it!" Ian cried.
Both heads jerked and cracked together with a sound of splitting melons. Jamie dropped the torch, which fell into the hole, and was promptly extinguished. A thin wisp of smoke drifted up from the rim of the hole, like incense. Jamie staggered out of the privy, hands clutching his forehead, eyes squeezed shut with pain. Young Ian leaned against the inside wall, hands pressed tightly over the crown of his head, making abrupt and breathless remarks in Gaelic. "Is it still alive?" I asked anxiously, peering toward the privy. Jamie opened one eye and regarded me under the clutching fingers.
"Oh, my head's fine, thanks," he said. "I expect my ears will have quit ringing by next week sometime."
"Now, now," I said soothingly. "It would take a sledgehammer to dent your skull. Let me look, though." I pushed his fingers aside and pulled his head down, feeling gently through the thick hair. There was a small bruised spot just above the hairline, but no blood. I kissed the spot perfunctorily and patted him on the head.
"You won't die," I said.
"Not from that, anyway."
"Oh, good," he said dryly. "I'd much rather die of snake bite next time I sit down to my business."
"It's a poisonous serpent, is it?"
Ian asked, letting go of his head and coming out of the privy. He inhaled deeply, filling his thin chest with fresh air.
"Venomous," Jamie corrected him. "If it bites you and makes you sick, it's venomous. If you bite it and it makes you sick, it's poisonous."
"Oh, aye,"
Ian said, dismissing this pedantry.
"It's a wicked snake, though."
"Very wicked," I said, with a slight shudder. "What are you going to do about it?" I asked, turning to Jamie. He raised one eyebrow.
"Me? Why ought I to do anything about it?" he asked.
"You can't just let him stay in there."
"Why not?"
he said, raising the other brow. Ian scratched his head absently, winced as he encountered the lump left by his collision with Jamie, and stopped.
"Well, I dinna ken, Uncle Jamie," he said dubiously. If you want to let your balls hang over a pit with a deadly viper in it, that's your concern. But the notion makes my flesh creep a bit. How big's the thing?
Fair-sized, I'll admit.
Jamie flexed his wrist, showing his forearm by way of comparison.
Yuck, said Ian.
You don't know they don't jump, I put in helpfully.
Aye, I do.
Jamie eyed me cynically.
Still, I grant you, the thought's enough to make one a bit costive.
How do you mean to get him out, though?
I could shoot him with your pistol,
Ian offered, brightening at the thought of getting his hands on Jamie's treasured pistols.
We needn't get him out if we can kill him.
Is he, visible? I put in delicately.
Jamie rubbed his chin dubiously. He hadn't shaved yet, and the dark red bristles rasped under his thumb.
Not very. There's no more than a few inches of filth in the pit, but I shouldn't think you could see him well enough to aim, and I hate to waste the shot.
We could invite all of the Hansons for dinner, serve beer and drown him, I suggested facetiously, naming a nearby and very numerous Quaker family. Ian erupted in giggles.
Jamie gave me an austere sort of look and turned toward the woods.
I'll think of something, he said, after my breakfast.
Breakfast was luckily no great problem, as the hens had helpfully provided me with 9 eggs, and the bread had risen satisfactorily. The butter was still immured in the back of the pantry, under the baleful guard of the newly farrowed sow, but Ian had managed to lean in and snatch a pot of jam from the shelf as I stood by with the broom, jabbing it into the sow's gnashing jaws as she made little darting charges at Ian's legs.
"I'll have to have a new broom," I remarked, eyeing the tattered remains as I dished up the eggs. "Perhaps I'll go up to the willow grove by the stream this morning."
"Mm-hmm."
Jamie reached out a hand and patted absently around on the table, searching for the bread plate. His attention was wholly focused on the book he was reading, Bricknell's Natural History of North Carolina.
"Here it is," he said. "I knew I'd seen a bit about rattlesnakes."
Locating the bread by feel, he took a piece, and used it to scoop a healthy portion of egg into his mouth. Having engulfed this, he read aloud, holding the book in one hand while groping over the tabletop with the other.
"The Indians frequently pull out the snake's teeth so that they never afterwards can do any mischief by biting. This may be easily done by tying a bit of red woolen cloth to the upper end of a long hollow cane, and so provoking the rattlesnake to bite, and suddenly pulling it away from him, by which means the teeth stick fast in the cloth, which are plainly to be seen by those present." "Have we any red cloth, Auntie?" Ian asked, washing down his own share of the eggs with chicory coffee.
I shook my head and speared the last of the sausages before Jamie's groping hand reached it.
"Blue, green, yellow, drab, white, and brown. No red."
"That's a fine wee book, Uncle Jamie," Ian said with approval. "Does it say more about the snakes?"
He looked hungrily over the expanse of table in search of more food. Without comment, I reached into the hutch and brought out a plate of spoon bread which I set before him. He sighed happily and waded in as Jamie turned the page.
"Well, here's a bit about how the rattlesnakes charm squirrels and rabbits."
Jamie touched his plate, but encountered nothing save bare surface. I pushed the muffins toward him.
"It is surprising to observe how these snakes will allure and charm squirrels, hedge conies, partridges, and many other small beasts and birds to them, which they quickly devour. The sympathy is so strong between these, that you shall see the squirrel or partridge, as they have espied this snake, leap or fly from bough to bough, until at last they run or leap directly into its mouth, not having power to avoid their enemy, who never stares out of the posture or coil until he obtains his prey."
His hand, blindly groping after sustenance, encountered the muffins. He picked one up and glanced up at me.
"Damned if I've ever seen that myself. Do you think it likely?"
"No,"
I said, pushing the curls back off my forehead. "Does that book have any helpful suggestions for dealing with vicious pigs?" He waved absently at me with the remains of his muffin.
"Dinna fash," he murmured. "I'll manage the pig."
He took his eyes off the book long enough to glance over the table at the empty dishes.
"Are there no more eggs?"
"There are, but I'm taking them up to our guest at the corn crib." I added two slices of bread to the small basket I was packing and took up the bottle of infusion I had left steeping overnight. The brew of goldenrod, bee balm, and wild bergamot was a blackish green and smelled like burnt fields, but it might help. It couldn't hurt. On impulse, I picked up the tied feather amulet old Nyawenny had given me. Perhaps it would reassure the sick man. Like the medicine, it couldn't hurt. Our impromptu guest was a stranger, a Tuscarora from a northern village. He had come to the farm several days before as part of a hunting party from Anauka on the Trail of Bear. We had offered food and drink. Several of the hunters were Ian's friends, but in the course of the meal I had noticed this man gazing glassy-eyed into his cup. Close examination had showed him to be suffering from what I was convinced was measles, an alarming disease in these days. He had insisted on leaving with his companions, but two of them had brought him back a few hours later, stumbling and delirious. He was plainly and alarmingly contagious. I had made him a comfortable bed in the newly built and so far empty corn crib, and forced his companions to go and wash in the creek, a proceeding which they plainly found senseless, but in which they humoured me before departing, leaving their comrade in my hands. The Indian was lying on his side, curled under his blanket. He didn't turn to look at me, though he must have heard my footsteps on the path.
"I could hear him, all right. No need for my makeshift stethoscope. The rails in his lungs were clearly audible at 6 paces.
"Comment ça va?" I said, kneeling down by him. He didn't answer. It was unnecessary in any case. I didn't need anything beyond the rattling wheeze to diagnose pneumonia, and the look of him merely confirmed it. Eyes sunken and dull, the flesh of his face fallen away, consumed to the bone by the fierce blaze of fever. I tried to persuade him to eat. He desperately needed nourishment, but he wouldn't even bother to turn away his face. The water bottle by his side was empty. I had brought more, but didn't give it to him right away, thinking he might swallow the infusion from sheer thirst. He did take a few mouthfuls, but then stopped swallowing, merely allowing the greenish-black liquid to run out of the corners of his mouth. I tried coaxing in French, but he was having none of it. He didn't even acknowledge my presence, just stared past my shoulder at the morning sky. His thin body sagged with despair. Plainly he thought himself abandoned, left to die in the hands of strangers. I felt a gnawing anxiety that he might be right. Surely he would die if he would take nothing. He would take water, at least. He drank thirstily, draining the bottle, and I went to the stream to fill it again. When I came back, I drew the amulet from my basket and held it up in front of his face. I thought I saw a flicker of surprise behind the half-closed lids. Nothing so strong as to be called hope. But he did at least take conscious notice of me for the first time. Seized by inspiration, I sank slowly down onto my knees. I had no notion at all of the proper ceremony to employ, but I had been a doctor long enough to know that while the power of suggestion was no substitute for antibiotics, it was certainly better than nothing. I held up the raven's feather amulet, turned my face skyward, and solemnly intoned the most sonorous thing I could remember, which happened to be Dr. Rawling's receipt for the treatment of syphilis, rendered in Latin. I poured a small bit of lavender oil into my hand, dipped the feather in it, and anointed his temples and throat while singing "Blow the Man Down" in a low, sinister voice. It might help the headache. His eyes were following the feather's movements. I felt rather like a rattlesnake charming away in its coil, waiting for a squirrel to run down my throat. I picked up his hand, laid the oil-drabbled amulet across his palm, and closed his fingers round it.
Then I took the jar of mentholated bear grease and painted mystic patterns on his chest, being careful to rub it well in with the balls of my thumbs. The reek cleared my sinuses. I could only hope it would help the patient's thick congestion. I completed my ritual by solemnly blessing the bottle of infusion with In nomine patri et filii et spiritu sancti. Amen. And presenting it to my patient's lips. Looking mildly hypnotized, he opened his mouth and obediently drank the rest. I drew the blanket up around his shoulders, put the food I had brought down beside him, and left him, with mixed feelings of hope and fraudulence. I walked slowly beside the stream, eyes alert as always for anything useful. It was too early in the year for most medicinals. For medicine, the older and tougher the plant, the better. Several seasons of fighting off insects ensured a higher concentration of the active principles in their roots and stems. Also, with many plants, it was the flower, fruit, or seed that yielded a useful substance. And while I'd spotted clumps of turtlehead and lobelia sprouting in the mud along the path, those had long since gone to seed. I marked the locations carefully in my mind for future reference, and went on hunting. Watercress was abundant. Patches of it floated among the rocks all along the margin of the stream, and a huge mat of the spicy, dark green leaves lay temptingly just ahead. A nice patch of scouring rushes, too. I had come down barefoot, knowing I'd be wading before long. I tucked up my skirts and ventured cautiously out into the stream, cutting knife in hand, and basket over my arm, breath sucked in against the freezing chill. My feet lost all feeling within moments, but I didn't care. I quite forgot the snake in the privy, the pig in the pantry, and the Indian in the corn crib, absorbed in the rush of water past my legs, the wet, cold touch of stems, and the breath of aromatic leaves. Dragonflies hung in the patches of sunshine on the shallows, and minnows darted past, snatching gnats too small for me to see. A kingfisher called in a loud, dry rattle from somewhere upstream, but he was after larger prey. The minnows scattered at my intrusion, but then swarmed back, grey and silver, green and gold, black marked with white, all insubstantial as the shadows from last year's leaves floating on the water. Brownian motion, I thought, seeing puffs of silt float up and swirl round my ankles, obscuring the fish. Everything moving, all of the time, down to the smallest molecule, but in its movement, giving the paradoxical impression of stillness, small local chaos giving way to the illusion of a greater order over all. I moved, too, taking my part in the stream's bright dance, feeling light and shadow change across my shoulders, toes searching for footholds among the slippery, half-seen rocks. My hands and feet were numb from the water. I felt as though I were half made of wood, yet intensely alive, like the silver birch that glowed above me, or the willows that trailed wet leaves in the pool below. Perhaps the legends of green men and the myths of transformed nymphs began this way, I thought. Not with trees come alive and walking, nor yet with women turned to wood, but with submersion of warm human flesh into the colder sensations of the plants, chilled to slow awareness. I could feel my heart beat slowly, and the half-painful throb of blood in my fingers. Sap rising. I moved with the rhythms of water and of wind, without haste or conscious thought, part of the slow and perfect order of the universe. I had forgotten the bit about small local chaos. Just as I came to the willow's bend, there was a loud shriek from beyond the trees. I'd heard similar noises from a variety of animals, from catamounts to hunting eagles, but I knew a human voice when I heard one. Blundering out of the stream, I shoved my way through the tangled branches and burst through into the clear space beyond. A boy was dancing on the bank above me, slapping madly at his legs and howling as he hopped to and fro. "What?" I began. And he glanced up at me, blue eyes wide with startlement at my sudden appearance.
He wasn't nearly as startled as I was. He was 11 or 12, tall and thin as a pine sapling, with a mad tangle of thick russet hair. Slanted blue eyes stared at me from either side of a knife-bridged nose, familiar to me as the back of my own hand, though I knew I had never seen this child before. My heart was somewhere in the vicinity of my tonsils, and the chill had shot up from my feet into the pit of my stomach. Trained to react in spite of shock, I managed to take in the rest of his appearance. Shirt and breeches of good quality, though splashed with water, and long pale shins blobbed with black clots like bits of mud. "Leeches," I said, professional calm descending by habit over personal tumult. It couldn't be, I was telling myself, at the same time that I knew it damn well was. "It's only leeches. They won't hurt you."
"I know what they are," he said. "Get them off me."
He swatted at his calf, shuddering with dislike.
"They're vile."
"Oh, not so terribly vile," I said, beginning to get a grip on myself. "They have their uses."
"I don't care what use they are,"
he bellowed, stamping in frustration.
"I hate them. Get them off me."
"Well, stop whacking at them," I said sharply. "Sit you down, and I'll take care of it." He hesitated, glaring at me suspiciously, but reluctantly sat down on a rock, thrusting his leech-spattered legs out in front of him.
"Get them off now," he demanded.
"In good time," I said. "Where did you come from?" He stared blankly at me.
"You don't live near here," I said with complete certainty. "Where did you come from?"
He made an obvious effort to collect himself.
We slept in a place called Salem 3 nights past. That was the last town I saw."
He wriggled his legs hard.
"Get them off, I say."
There were assorted methods of getting leeches off, most of them somewhat more damaging than the leeches themselves. I had a look. He'd picked up 4 on one leg, 3 on the other. One of the fat little beasts was already near bloat, gone plump and shiny with stretching. I edged a thumbnail under its head, and it popped off into my hand, round as a pebble and heavy with blood. The boy stared at it, pale under his tan, and shuddered.
"Don't want to waste it," I said casually, and went to retrieve the basket I had dropped under the branches as I pushed my way through the trees.
Nearby I saw his coat on the ground, discarded shoes and stockings with it. Simple buckles on the shoes, but silver, not pewter. Good broadcloth, not showy, but cut with a deal more style than one saw anywhere north of Charleston. I hadn't really needed confirmation, but there it was. I scooped up a handful of mud, pressed the leech gently into it, and wrapped the gooey blob in wet leaves, only then noticing that my hands were trembling. The idiot, the deceitful, wicked, conniving... What in hell had made him come here? And God, what would Jamie do? I came back to the boy, who was bent double, peering at the remaining leeches with a look of disgusted loathing. One more was close to dropping as I knelt in front of him. It fell off, bouncing slightly on the damp ground.
"Ugh," he said.
"Where's your stepfather?" I asked abruptly. Few things could have taken his attention off his legs, but that did. His head jerked up, and he stared at me in astonishment. It was a cool day, but a light dew of sweat shone on his face. It was narrower through cheek and temple, I thought, and the mouth was quite unlike. Perhaps the resemblance was not really so pronounced as I thought.
"How do you know me?"
he asked, drawing himself up with an air of hauteur that would have been extremely funny under other circumstances. "All I know about you is that your given name is William. Am I right?" My hands curled at my sides, and I hoped I was wrong. If he was William, that wasn't quite all I knew about him, but it was plenty to be going on with. A hot flush rose into his cheeks, and his eyes raked over me, his attention temporarily distracted from the leeches by being so familiarly addressed by what, I suddenly realized, appeared to be a dishevelled beldame with her skirts round her thighs. Either he had good manners, or the disparity